Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and, yes, practitionership here in American soccer. Today is a very important discussion on the principle of doing less and not more. Now, what the heck does that mean? Because everybody thinks, oh, you got to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way to Z to develop a player, to develop a team, to develop a coach, to develop a club. And that is pure horseshit, okay? You have to do much, much, much less. You have to be focused. And hence the principle of doing less and not more. Of course, many coaches fall prey to doing more, and a lot of clubs fall prey to doing more, as do parents, as do players. So again, what does this actually mean when we're talking about technical training, when we're talking about tactical training and other things? So Benny joins me to unpack this discussion. I hope you enjoy. And as always, coaches, if you want to learn how to do less and not more, you need to go to 343coaching.com and pick up the methodology that launched and pioneered a whole revolution here in American soccer, from youth to pro, frankly. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you too can get a stranglehold on this methodology and help your kids throughout the landscape. So coaches, 343coaching.com, there are free and premium programs for you there. And parents, 343masterclass.com. Coaches, by the way, if you're coaching the little ones in the 7-versus-7 format, we've developed a whole course specialized just for that. And that is at 7v7coaching.com. All right, here we go with Benny Rogers on doing less, not more. Enjoy. What are we talking about today, man?
Everything, G. It's all related. Everything. So, Gary, we've given a lot of love to the 343 Masterclass. I think it'd be good to show some love to the coaches out there that are in the trenches every day. And there's a lot of coaches that tune in. So I think pulling a lesson from the 343 coaching education platform, I thought it would be a good idea today. Something that kind of relates to, you know, not just the coaches, but also to the masterclass as well. But it's a lesson titled The Golden Rule to Team and Player Development. And within this lesson, you mentioned that it kind of references the previous lesson, which was the huge mistake that well-meaning coaches are making, meaning that, you know, they're just jumping from activity to activity, pulling random ideas and different training activities into their sessions, and there's no continuity within the players. And the way that you end the lesson of the golden rule to team and player development is with the simple phrase, do less, not more. So I kind of wanted to pick your brain a little bit as to, you know, how you kind of came up with this philosophy and why it's so important for coaches to do less, not more. And maybe, you know, for lazy coaches or players, that can kind of sound like a cop-out. It's like, oh, Gary's recommending that I do less in my sessions, but I think that's the wrong idea. I think what you're really saying is stick to the foundation, stick to the core. And until your team shows a level of mastery is when you can start to, you know, layer in more complex ideas.
Yeah, it's all connected, like you said, Benny. The masterclass, the coaching education platform, everything we talk about, the articles that we've been writing since 2009, it's all connected. All the lessons are connected. You might be talking about something that seems completely a world apart from something else. And an example doesn't come to my mind at the moment, but there is always that connection. So yeah, so let's see. The first thing that came to mind, because I just started teaching at the university again, it is the first week of classes. And usually the classes that I have are host to engineering majors, first and foremost. So computer engineering, computer science, mechanical, electrical, civil, you name it. And over the course of many, many years, I've kind of narrowed the scope of what I present to the students over the course of 15 weeks. In the very beginning, you know, you have an ambitious lesson plan, you want to touch on all of these different topics. And the fact of the matter is that the more topics I would touch on, the less the students would learn. I mean, they would get exposed to different terms and terminology and get a little sample of wildly different things, but there was no retention there. You know, it was always move on to the next, move on to the next, move on to the next. And it does students a huge disservice, in my opinion. And also, something that's a little bit more difficult to realize, it does the teacher, professor, instructor, coach a huge disservice also when you're doing a bunch of different things, Ben, instead of a select few number of things. And the way it does a disservice is as follows. First, let's focus on the student, i.e. the players here, if we're talking soccer. They never become good at anything. So one day you're teaching them to juggle with the right foot. The next day you're saying, oh, don't do it with the right foot anymore. Do it with the left foot. The next day you're saying, hey, just use your thighs. The next day you're just using your head. The next day you're saying, hey, you get what I'm saying? The stupid juggling example. So cool. You get exposed to everything. Cool. You maybe lift your level of competence marginally in all of those things over the course of a year. But what if you had just focused on two of the 10 things that I just riffed off? Imagine how much better they would be at just those two things. So what does that bring us to? It brings us to what two things out of the 10 you should really be focusing in on. And that requires a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, and frankly, a good chunk of expertise to be able to say these two things are the most important things of the 10. Because if you get these two things, then maybe you can start doing the other eight that remain, and you'll be able to do the other eight that remain much more easily. It'll come to you. So you're searching for the fundamental principles always. And the same thing goes for my teaching in the academic setting. In physics, there's a huge array of topics that you can focus on. And you know, over the course of 15, 20 years, in one particular course, let's say, that huge array of topics has been narrowed to maybe 20% or 30% of what it used to be. And then the students really get to dive in deep, go really deep down the rabbit hole on each one of those topics. And that develops their competencies, that develops the richness of their understanding, that develops nuance in what it is that they're trying to learn. And that lasts a lifetime, Ben. You learn how to learn as opposed to staying superficial with any one particular thing. So that's on the student side. And then on the instructor, professor, coach side of the equation, the same is true. You're, instead of staying superficial with everything, you're going really deep down the rabbit hole on a select few number of things, and all kinds of new knowledge that you never knew existed start unlocking, and all kinds of new connections that you never knew existed start becoming connected in your mind. And now you've developed some, what I would call expertise. And sometimes people talk about mastery because Robert Greene wrote a really great book over a decade ago, literally called Mastery. I would recommend, highly recommend everybody read it. So that term comes into the mix once in a while, but I reserve that for like the true Six Sigma geniuses, outlier geniuses out there. I would never call myself a master in anything. I think that is a lifelong journey. And if you're lucky, maybe you get a little whiff of that term mastery by the time you're 67 years old. I don't know because I'm not there, Ben. But I think those are the things that came to mind when you presented this topic of the golden rule to team and player development. Do less, not more. So I spoke about the player side, the coaching side, and now maybe we can even talk about the team side of the equation.
Yeah, especially for younger coaches, it can be really tempting to just kind of move on and start with new things. Like for me in my first year of coaching, right? A problem that I would find is, you know, after the games, or for example, let's say all month we're working on just building out of the back. And okay, they're starting to slowly but surely improve. And then after the game, you have parents coming up to you saying like, coach, the kids have no idea how to even throw in the ball, or they have no idea how to score goals. And so like the parents are putting pressure on you to start moving on to new ideas and new activities. And at some point you do have to keep the parents happy. Otherwise, you know, they're going to be leaving teams. So I think a lot of young coaches feel that pressure to sort of pick and choose. All right, like, yeah, the parents are right. They don't know how to throw in the balls. I'm going to spend the next 2 weeks throwing it in. Or the next 2 weeks, I'm going to work on finishing only. versus sticking to that core foundation principles that is going to help your team succeed. So it is for sure tempting for younger coaches who don't have that expertise to, hey, I got to move on from this. Otherwise, the parents aren't going to be happy.
Yeah. So much to double click into there. Number one, this is where you would hope that you have a very potent, powerful, persuasive director of coaching or technical director, whoever the guy responsible for the club is, for them to shield young coaches from these sorts of pressures. If you have that, then you're one of the lucky ones because that provides you some time to work in peace. Number one, if you don't have that, then it gets more complicated. Like you said, the antidote or the immunity or the vaccine, I would say in that circumstance for the young coach to be able to work in peace, unfortunately, comes down to, are you winning games? Because if you're winning games, then the parents are, what are they going to say? They're not going to come up to you and say, hey, you're doing things wrong. You shouldn't be doing the same exercises, core exercises over and over again. My kid should be experiencing all these different sorts of flavors. So there comes that added component of the pressure to win. And here we like to say pressure, you know, winning at all costs, which I hate. I hate the expression. Not that I hate winning at all costs. I hate the expression that's used or the framing of it all. But unfortunately, now you see another angle to the incentives in the youth soccer system here in the country. So if you're a coach, even an experienced one, Ben, it doesn't even have to be the new coach or the inexperienced one, even the experienced ones, you have this loom, this cloud over your head of you have to win games in order for you to continue your art of coaching in the training sessions in peace. Okay. So yeah, it's complicated. Of course, it's linked to promotion relegation. We won't go there at the moment. We'll leave that for the end of the episode. But for sure, man, and it just sucks that young coaches have to go, and every young person in every profession has to go through the learning curve themselves and the experience curve and the acquiring of wisdom, which nobody can give to you. So it's going to take you 5-10 years before you kind of graduate from being the freshman, so to speak, and maybe being bullied around by the parents or being bullied around by the DOC or being bullied around by administrators. You know, it's unfortunate. You know, this was always my hope also with the 343 coaching program, is to help them make that curve shorter, you know, and accelerate them on that path to experience and wisdom faster. Because if you're always in trial and error mode, then you actually might never get there, for one. And if you do actually get there, we're talking over a decade for sure. And it's a minority who actually get there on their own. And then, you know, what we attempted to develop is to short circuit that and hopefully make the runway a more peaceful one. So maybe after just a few years, coaches are having wild success and they've accrued that credibility with their families and with their players and with the club, and to the point where it's kind of like, I get to do what I want at this point. Now, some people have success really fast, Benny. I know you've seen a lot of the emails that we get over the years. Some folks get success within 6 months, you know, and not only they're getting peace and quiet at home, but they get compliments by opposing coaches, compliments by referees. They start getting recruited by other clubs at times because they want good coaches, obviously. But then there's some coaches that it takes a little bit longer because maybe the material that they're working with, and here, forgive me, but I'm calling the players material, isn't quite at the same level, but they can get there too. It just might take a little bit longer.
Yeah. And you mentioned this idea of winning kind of giving you breathing room. Like the first team that I was talking about, I was fortunate. My first team ever was a U10 girls team, right? And I had, I don't know, 4 or 5 man-childs, or woman-childs, I guess you could call them. And Gary, it didn't matter what I did at the sessions. I could drop a line of cones and have them dribble through it for an hour. We were still going to win every single game. But okay, that's obviously part of B43. That's not what I did. We would work on building out of the back and all these things. And even though we were winning games, Gary, I can remember one game, like the girls were attempting to build out of the back and the other team was high-pressing us and they were struggling with it. But there's a parent across the field. He's like, coach, it's not working. Try something else. I'm like, seriously, like, dude, I ended up ripping that guy after the game. But, you know, even when you are winning, you know, the parents, they're going to find something to like pick at, or, you know, they're like, just kick it to the girl up top. We could score like that. Like, to them, the development doesn't matter. It's like, are we going to win this game or not? You know?
True. It never ends. We've talked about this numerous times, but for folks who are new on the show, even folks who have been here a while with us for years, they'll forgive me for repeating myself, but it never ends, Benny. No matter what level you're at, no matter how experienced you are as a coach, look, now you have so many people who have been biting their tongues for years, now ripping on Guardiola. See, Guardiola's a fraud. He's always been a fraud. You know, he loses one key guy in midfield, and all of a sudden the team can't do anything. So even the top level where coaches are absolutely obsessed with the game, in my opinion, masters, I would probably call Guardiola a master from my vantage point. Even the masters get shit on. So it doesn't matter. We just have to develop that thick skin.
Yeah. And this is something else. I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but, you know, obviously I've had access to the entire 3-4-3 methodology, you know, since I first started coaching. And the mistake that I made is like, all right, I have access to phase six. Like, oh, I'm going to just jump ahead and, oh, this activity looks fantastic. I'm going to run it with my session with my team tonight. And of course the players, you know, they couldn't grasp it and they weren't ready. So I think you get a lot of emails, Gary, saying like, oh, can I jump ahead, or can I get access to this part of the course? But I think it's a huge mistake, Gary, because if your players don't have that foundational core, then there's no point in doing these activities if they're not ready to do it.
Yeah, that's why it was designed the way it was, you know, in phases, dripped out on a yearly basis. And folks probably aren't used to that. Folks are used to purchasing online products and services, and you get to pick and choose what you want, and you get everything all in one shebang. And from my perspective, it's like, no, I mean, I could do that, and certainly we'd have more revenue, but that's a complete disservice and goes against what we know to be true, which is coaches need to take it one step at a time, because players need to also take it one step at a time, and teams need to take it one step at a time. So when you first join, it's phase one. It's the fundamental principles. Get the fundamental principles down pat. Like, get them to a level of competence that you as the coach actually know what you're doing. And that's not going to happen in 1 month. You're going to have to work on it for a year at least for you to even start unlocking some of the secrets of the activities and why they work and how to actually do them. And then, okay, year two, you graduate to adding a little bit of a layer of complexity to that core that you've already established. And then year three, let's add another little layer of complexity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So by the time, you know, year five or six comes around, I mean, the hope is if you've been serious and committed, man, you're coming out the other side an absolute beast of a coach, and your players have benefited to the nth degree. But it's a good example that you gave that, you know, obviously because you're part of the family here, you've been a coach for a long time. Yeah, look, you even fell prey to it after being a coach for quite a number of years yourself. You got the whole shebang, you know, you got 6 years worth of content there. And I don't know, you can maybe say why you skipped forward. Maybe did you get bored? Did you just want to experiment? And how did you come across? I mean, did you really understand when you ended up doing that it was a mistake?
I think within the first 5 minutes of running the activity, it's like, this was a massive mistake. Because, but no, Gary, it comes down to that, the pressure of the parents putting on you. It's like, coach, why are we doing the same 10 activities for the past 6 months? You know, and this is, you know, you probably sound like a broken record here, but this is why the importance of educating your parents as to what it is that you're doing. Otherwise, you're going to run into the problems. And early in my career, the first 2-3 years, I didn't do a good job of educating the parents, which is why I felt that pressure, you know, which is why they felt like they could come up to me after practice and say, you know, coach, like, are you going to move on from this subject? Or, you know, look at in the game, the kids, they still don't know how to do the throw in, or, you know, other teams are doing 6 set pieces but, you know, the kids aren't ready.
Yeah. Yeah, they just have to trust. They just have to trust the coach. But unfortunately, it's not there. And unfortunately, since it's pay to play, they're emboldened to all be assistant coaches on the sideline and all be assistant coaches 24/7. I'm sure you get text messages still to this day, all the time, Benny, with suggestions of how to do things better. You can imagine all the stories that we have too, right? We had parents, you know, calling their own kid Iniesta, you know, because this was during that period also.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, like you just have to put him in like the right system, you know, and build a team around him and stuff. Like he is literally, I'm telling you, he is like Iniesta part two. God, and I'll never forget it, man. It was a big long ass. I don't remember if it was an email or a text message. It was an email. It was actually an email. Maybe I can even go dig through it and make a whole episode out of that. I mean, look, it's been like 12 years since this happened, and I won't name any names or something, but I'll just read the whole email for folks to get a flavor of what it is that we're exposed to.
And I'm guessing the player was shocking and not getting playing time.
Shocking. Shocking, Benny. Shocking. So bad.
What kind of like benchmark or indicators should a coach be looking for in terms of like when they feel that they're ready to start layering in more complex ideas? Does it have to be like, all right, my team's starting to connect 15 to 20 passes a game, or we finally, you know, we're successfully able to build out every single time? Is it at that point that you can say like, all right, these guys are ready to move on?
Yeah, this is where the art of coaching comes into play. So it's not a science. So when folks ask me for metrics or benchmarks, they're looking for something quantifiable. And I get it. I understand why. It's just very difficult because there's so many more metrics, or not metrics, there's so many more things, moving pieces that need to be considered. And frankly, some instinct on the part of the coach and experience from the part of the coach to kind of say, okay, this group is ready to be taught the inside outside pattern in the build out play, you know, or to train certain básicos or things of that nature. So it's tough to answer. I think a good first order indicator or some of the things that you mentioned is your team consistently able to have five pass sequences, let's say, in possession? And this is dependent on age and level as well, Benny. Because if you're consistently having five pass sequences, maybe at U15 at the highest levels, then that's not that impressive necessarily. But if you're able to do five pass sequences consistently throughout a game for 11-year-olds, then it's like, ooh, okay, the kids are getting it. The kids get it, you know, and maybe we can start layering other things. The other thing that is important, aside from saying an objective metric like five pass sequences or possession percentage or things of that nature, is what is the level of the individual players that you have? Because your individual players might be extremely low level, among the lowest of levels in your competitive circuit, and you can still get them and teach them to connect five pass sequences constantly because your competitive circuit is low level and your opponent is low level. So your opponent doesn't know how to pressure you or stop you from doing those sorts of things. And then that might not be the best of indicators to move on to more advanced activities because your players themselves aren't capable of executing more advanced technical ideas. You feel me? So it really depends, Ben, but that's the first order objective that I would look at, is consistency in five pass sequences, for instance, or seven passes or six passes or four passes. I mean, you have to be the judge of that too. And winning, because if you're not winning, then you're going to be in trouble.
Right, right. You mentioned this idea of the lower level player. You know, I feel like some coaches find themselves in the dilemma of maybe 75% of their roster is able to execute these ideas that they're trying to implement, and then it's that bottom 25% that are continuing to struggle. So let's talk about cutting players, Gary. At what point should a coach, you know, decide, hey, it's in the best interest for you to move on to another thing? I hear a lot of coaches say like, oh, I don't believe in cutting players. Like, everybody deserves a chance, or I don't want to break the kid's heart. Like, I myself, on the first club team that I was ever on at 9 years old, I was cut, and like, I was heartbroken. I was devastated, but it ended up being the best possible thing for me because that's how I got the opportunity to go and play for Brian's team. You know, so like, for me, I look back, I'm like, I'm happy that he released me from that team because it was a blessing in disguise, kind of. But then again, you hear coaches say like, oh, I'll never cut a player from my teams. So what's your stance on releasing players and letting them go?
Yeah. Look, I'm not going to demonize coaches, but I would say there is a percentage of coaches who say that because they just don't want any problems. right? And they don't want they're non-confrontational folks, which I understand. And so they don't want to have that conversation with a family saying you're cut, this sort of thing. But that's beside the point. You know, number one, there's, again, incentives and pressures on coaches that we need to understand. We're in a pay-to-play system by and far. And so you're not incentivized necessarily to cut players who are paying club dues. There's an issue there already. I mean, you can do it, but you also have to have a replacement lined up so those club dues aren't interrupted. So that's one thing that came to mind. The other thing that came to mind is the whole notion of what are youth sports for? We can go down this path of saying, hey, youth sports also serve a broader function to not just society, but the individual participants of it, which is an early proxy into life itself, because you're exposed to teamwork, you're exposed to friendships, you're exposed to competition, you're exposed to the like boss and employee or teacher and student relationship. All these sorts of dynamics, right? Which are in everyday life. And so if you agree with that, then, you know, one of the things that the players should be learning are life lessons as well. And one of those life lessons is rejection. Happens all the time. And one of those life lessons is getting fired or being cut in whatever manifestation that presents itself in. And so we don't have to look at it as a negative thing necessarily when somebody is cut, like you just illustrated. You know, one door closes, another one opens for you. A fresh start, a clean slate is presented to you after one door closes. So we can always look at it from that perspective. But if I'm being charitable to the coaches who say, oh no, you know, we should never cut players and everybody should have like equal playing time, and they're running this sort of socialist sort of thing, great. I just don't think you're doing many people favors by doing that. I don't think you're doing the other players on the team a favor. So imagine the best player on the team, or the best players on the team, or the top half of the team. They have their own goals and objectives too. You know, they want to maybe win games so that they can become more visible on the broader club scene. They want to develop further themselves as well. And that is probably being harmed if the overall level of the team is lower because the bottom 25% of players shouldn't be there or aren't very good. So you're harming the higher level player in that regard by trying to say you're doing the right thing by not cutting the bottom end of the roster. So you're actually harming more players, right, by protecting one or two players. So that's another thing to definitely consider. And yeah, man, so I don't want to say I struggle with it, but I just think we have to reframe this conversation that we have in American soccer in the way that I kind of presented it. We have to recruit and we have to cut. And I think there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, man, this is really the problem with this whole like pay to play idea is that, you know, if these parents of the bottom 25% of the roster are paying the coach's paycheck, like the coach is content and happy. It's like, what reason does he have to get rid of the player? If it was an open system and, you know, there was incentives to actually win and be successful, you wouldn't see this happening. And the other thing that I think a lot of coaches, especially like in the, I don't want to say less fortunate areas, or what's the word I'm looking for?
Lower socioeconomic situations. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, I guarantee you there's coaches that find these players that are phenomenal and fantastic, and they want to sign them to their team. And then they send the parent the bill, and the parents are like, sorry, there's no chance I can afford this, you know? And think about how many players aren't getting that opportunity just because, you know, their parents can't afford to play, you know? And I think this, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but I think this is why TFA has had so much success at the youth level, is that majority of their teams or players, they don't have to pay. Was that the case with Brian's teams? Like a lot of them weren't having to pay?
Yeah. So Brian, obviously in conjunction with the president of the club, Paul Walker, you know, they launched that, the so-called academy. And before anybody was calling anything an academy around here, launched the academy. And that was always the idea, is if not fully funded, make it majority funded by outside sources, whether it's donations or whether it be operating income from elsewhere. So you can actually give these kids and these families an opportunity that they would otherwise really never have, Benny. So I think that was a great service to so many kids and so many families. And obviously on the upside is the sporting side of the equation, right? Because now all of a sudden you don't have that restriction of recruiting players. I mean, you're still going to have to compete for the players because other clubs also have scholarship programs or whatever, who might be competing for the best players in the area. But the discussion that you just, or what you just presented, is not really a friction point that normal coaches have to experience. So yeah, for sure. I wanted to add one thing before I forget about the pay to play and parents. In my experience, it also seems that there's a high probability that the parents whose kids are, let's say, the bottom 25% of the roster, like they're really struggling at this particular level, those parents are usually the ones who become the most quote unquote powerful on the team. Not just because they're paying to play, but since their kids are struggling the most to actually play, they become more and more engaged in the politics of club soccer and in the politics of the particular club that a coach might be at, and form coalitions with the other parents or the other players who don't play very much. And so they then present themselves as a block of, say, five parents or four parents or whatever it is. One of them might even volunteer to be the team manager, you know, and the other one might volunteer to be like the team treasurer or the club treasurer or something, because they know that the only chance for their kid to have any chance of playing time or moving up is if they now wield things that are off the field, wield political influence and political power. So there's all that secondary and tertiary effects to pay to play that we don't discuss in this country, but people need to be made aware of.
That block of four or five parents can cause a lot of friction within that team, because if you have five parents going to your DOC saying, you know, this coach doesn't know what he's doing, or, you know, the parents aren't happy, it causes friction. And not only that, for them to go to the DOCs, but they'll go to the parents of the top 75% on the team and, you know, start talking behind the coach's back saying, is this coach really developing your kid? You know, is this the best environment for us? So
totally toxic, totally toxic, man. It destroys teams. It impedes clubs. It's terrible, terrible environment, terrible situation. Again, it's all because we don't have promotion relegation at the professional level. All of it, all of this happens because of that. The other, to wrap this up also, the other thing is at the high end of the roster, the best player or two players, the parents don't really get all that involved usually, because as you can imagine, kids always playing, kids the star of the team, might be one of the best players in the league. Well, that family and that kid has options. They could just bounce and just go to another team and play there. It's no big deal whatsoever. So those parents don't have to wield political influence, political power, form coalitions, cause disruptions. That's a big headache. Nobody wants to do that, you know? So if you're the parent of one of the best players, you don't do that for the most part. I've seen exceptions to the rule, okay? But you don't have to do that because you got options. Oh, I'll just go over here. No problem. Go to this other club team who'll pay all my fees. No problem.
Were there instances with Brian's team where you saw this happen, where this bottom 25% of the team started causing friction?
Ben, I don't open my mouth unless I know what I'm talking about. I think we talked about that last time. So yeah, more experience with this than 10 lifetimes worth, okay?
Sounds good. I'll ask you in 10 lifetimes.
I'm on my 10th one now, dude.
Random, but do you believe in reincarnation?
I have no idea. Benny, I have no idea what's going on in this universe. I majored and studied and became one of these, trained in physics, which that is the goal of physics, right? Is understanding the universe as best as possible. I have no clue, zero clue. You know, I'm becoming more and more persuaded that we're in a simulation, that's for sure. And I've heard of simulation theory for over a decade. But as the years go by and as computer systems get more and more sophisticated, and I work with computer systems at the programming level quite extensively, It just seems like we're in a simulation, Ben. It's really weird. So if we're in a simulation, going back to your question, can you be reincarnated? Sure, of course. Why not?
A massive rabbit hole there, Gary. But, you know, going back to this golden rule of doing less, not more, can you talk a little bit about like the core activities that coaches should be doing, especially within their first, you know, 1 to 2 years taking over a team, you know? Obviously for the coaches that are members of the program, they know the activities that we offer, but you know, for the general public that doesn't, maybe we can expand a little on it.
Yeah. So let's start broadly and then maybe zoom in just a little bit. Obviously it's hard in audio form to talk about activities and exercises because you know why. So you're principally looking at developing technique and tactical acumen, first and foremost. The mentality side of the equation is important, as is the physical side, but in development, in youth player development, it's technical and tactical come first and foremost, and then the other stuff needs to be laced in there separately or in some other form. So from a technique perspective, you know, Brian adopted rondos, for technical development. And, you know, he didn't invent these things. This has a long history, principally overseas, principally in Spain, principally with Johan Cruyff and even his mentors and his predecessors. But it all kind of culminated with Pep Guardiola's FC Barcelona's unprecedented dominance, playing possession-based football and the training methodology. They're not just at the pro level, but at the youth level, starting with the smallest of ages at the famous La Masia, was all about rondos. And these are small-sided exercises. Maybe it's 4 to 5 to 6 players per exercise. So you kind of segregate the team into 3 stations or 2 stations or however many you have on your roster. And they're kind of close quarters passing exercises that teach you how to receive the right way, how to receive a pass, and then how to dish a pass the right way. And in many respects, how to defend also, and how to recognize, you know, what the next pass is going to be and adjust your body and adjust your positioning accordingly. So there's a series of these technical rondos that are done as the core. I don't know how many they are. Maybe there's like 4 of them, Benny. There's the 4v0. Like if you're very unsophisticated and you can't have a defender in the rondo yet, there's the 4v1. And then obviously you can do the 3v1, which has more dynamics and becomes more complicated to do. Then there's a so-called double rondo where it's kind of like you're putting 2 4v1s together into one activity. So you have a series of, say, 5 or 6 of these sorts of things. And if you do them religiously every single training session for months and months and years, to give you an idea, in Barcelona, I don't know how it is. I haven't been there in a while, but historically and for years and years and years, from U9 up to and including the actual first team professionals, this is what they're doing every single training session. Okay. To give you the scope of, you don't stop doing them. You'll start seeing incredible technical development of your players by doing these sorts of things. And they are fundamental principles in the sense that what is most fundamental, how to receive a pass, how to receive a ball, and then how to execute a pass. That's, it doesn't get more fundamental than that. Fundamental is not juggling the ball or being able to juggle the ball 150 times. Are you developing some sort of technique when you do that and are able to accomplish some juggling stuff? Yes, you are developing some sort of technique, like foot sensitivity, whatever, but you are not developing a fundamental technique of the game, like receiving a ball and passing a ball. So that gives you an indication of what we mean by fundamental principles of the game and the core exercises that build you up for later, more complex stuff. So that's on the rondo side, the technical development emphasis. On the tactical side, I know I'm going on for a long time here. I'm going to keep it brief. On the tactical side, you don't want to play random football where you're just kicking it forward and hopefully you get it and hopefully you score. And then the other team kicks it, launches it forward. And then you're just going ping pong back and forth. It's random roulette jungle ball soccer. That doesn't develop shit. Okay. So you want to actually build a team that actually knows how to play football so that the individuals within that team are developing their soccer intellects, right? The tactical side of the thing. So how do we do that? Well, you start from the base, building out of the back. Okay. You start with the keeper and your back line, depending if you're playing 11v11, 7v7, 8v8, whatever. You build out of the back. So what do? You get the guys who are participating in the back line and you teach them how to space themselves out in possession. You teach them how to rotate the ball from one side of the field to the other side of the field, and you hammer that into them over and over and over again, first without any pressure. And then maybe you throw in one defender to go chase like a chicken with his head cut off, you know, to try to intercept passes. And then you evolve to maybe throwing two defenders of that back line of, say, four plus the goalkeeper. So it's kind of like 5 versus 2. You should still be rather successful once you have some competence in doing the exercise. Because don't get me wrong, if you start throwing pressure right away at players who have not been trained with no pressure at all, they won't be successful. If you throw in two defenders at five players trying to build out of the back, but the five players have never been trained at it, it's brand new to them, they are going to lose the ball, which is crazy to think about because it's 5 versus 2, Benny. You should never lose the ball. It's crazy, but they'll lose it. So that's building out of the back. Next thing you want to do is transition to the midfield. So you teach the midfielders how to check away from the ball, how to check to the ball, how to orient their bodies to receive properly. So how to lose your man, right? Because you're probably marked there or you don't have enough space. So find the space. And then you teach the back line how to inject passes to the midfielders or inject passes to the wingers or inject passes to your center forward. But all of this is still in the middle of the field, not in the attacking third, okay? And how to retain possession there. So that is all taught. And then finally transitioning into the final third where you want to go and score, we train attacking patterns of play, which means patterns that happen in football, generally speaking, over and over and over again. These are just established patterns that happen naturally in football. So it's a fundamental principle. What's an example? An example is like a setting up a 2v1 overlap with your outside back. That happens all the time. Why? Because you always want to have a numerical advantage when you're attacking. Otherwise, your attack's probably going to fail. So how do you create those numerical advantages? You need somebody from the midfield or somebody from the back line even to go and join the attack. Now, how do they join the attack? So that's kind of like the example of a overlap by the fullback. So maybe your midfielder dishes a ball to the winger. That triggers your outside back to make a run and overlap your outside winger. Your outside winger now with the fullback has a 2v1 with the outside back of the opposing team. And now the winger has a decision to make. The decision is, do I dish it to my overlapping fullback? And then he goes on to do damage. Or do I not do that? And I go do the damage because the defender is you know, focus on the overlapping fullback, or has the opposing team kind of neutralized that some way, or it's not going to work this time, and resets all the play. So I'm just giving you three sort of decisions that maybe that one particular player has on their plate at that time, which introduces the notion of creativity, Benny. Okay. Because even though we're training patterns of play, the player is developing a vision and a feel for the game as to what decisions to make and what decisions not to make, and they can be creative in their choice of decisions because they could also dribble, right? There's four choices. So that's how we also implement or inject creativity. We're not telling them exactly what to do. We're giving them structure, which will enable them from within that organized structure to express themselves. So that's the whole core of the first year of the methodology in a nutshell. If your team really assimilates this, if you as the coach really assimilate this and gain some competence and you start seeing these five pass sequences developing all over the field and these patterns developing all over the field, then you're ready to graduate maybe into more advanced topics so you can layer onto this base. How'd I do?
That was a lot, but very informative for coaches. I think, you know, as you were speaking, I'm kind of just putting myself in the shoes of coaches and, you know, problems that I hear. One thing for sure is, you know, obviously there's a lot in there to unpack. And for most coaches, you know, they only meet twice a week with their teams, an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half. So to fit, you know, all of that in is a challenge for them. The other thing that a lot of coaches and clubs struggle with is field space, meaning like, okay, my team only, let's say it's a full soccer field. My team has a quarter of the entire field. So how can I work on attacking patterns within that small quarter of the field? You know, these are just some problems that I hear from other coaches. So for those instances, what do you do?
It's true. No, it's true, Ben. And those are all valid points. First off, the rondos don't take a large portion of the field. So no matter what, you're going to be able to execute the technical development side of the equation with the rondos, which also, by the way, have tactical stuff injected in there. Like the losing your man, like the building out of the back, and even sort of patterns can be injected into rondos also. But on the broader point, so things like building out the back, there's no question you need sufficient space. Now, it's a matter of what is sufficient space. Do you need a full field to train building out of the back? No. Do you need a half a field necessarily? Not necessarily. Okay. Maybe if you have a quarter of the field, right? But the width of that quarter is maybe, I don't know, half the width or three quarters of the width of an actual football field, then you could be in business because you can still get the principles, the idea certainly established into the players' minds. And I think that's probably true for the remaining activities like losing your man. You don't necessarily need a half a field. A quarter of a field could do just fine. The issue will come into attacking patterns for the most part, because the way we like to finish attacking patterns is you actually have a goal there with a goalkeeper and you finish the play. You execute the attacking pattern and that culminates with a finish or a strike on goal. So you probably need, like a quarter of the field, right? If it's on the right side of the field where you're doing the attacking pattern, it's that right lane. If it's on the left side, it's the left lane. If it's down the middle, it's down the middle. So you have to sometimes be a little bit creative, Benny, but maybe you can give me a little bit of your experience, because I'm sure that you've maybe experienced this yourself, because you haven't been necessarily at a club that is fully funded, the club. You know, like these MLS academies per se, or even the TFA back when Brian started it. So I'm sure you've run into these challenges, and you can chime in.
Yeah, and I think probably some coaches are laughing, hearing like, what the fuck? I have two entire fields if I wanted it every single day. But, you know, you see coaches like that and they just set up a small field in the middle and just like a small sided field. So not even taking advantage of what they have. But for me, I've been fortunate to have, you know, in my session, at least half a field. So, but even like you said, Gary, when you do have, you know, a quarter of field space, you know, if you just go the width of that space, even if you're just making it a little bit smaller, but you're still giving them the ideas of, hey, this is the movement that you need to do. Even if they're in a smaller space, they have to be able to, you know, get the ball off their feet quicker and, you know, move the ball with purpose. And then when they move into that bigger space, it becomes easier for them. So, you know, there is advantages to it. It's cheesy, but I like to say, if there's a will, there's a way. You know, you can always find things to work on. And especially like you mentioned, there's so many activities that you can do that's going to help develop their core fundamentals.
Yeah. That's a good point. That actually you can look at it as an advantage sometimes because you're in tight space. Very good point. Let me bring us full circle to the do less, not more thing again, because when I gave you my brain dump of the first year of the program and the core principles, you said, yeah, that's a lot. You know, it's a lot. Not really, right? Because it seemed like it, but it's really just like a set of 10 exercises that encapsulate all this. They encapsulate the rondos, the building out of the back, the losing your man, and the attacking patterns. It's a suite of maybe 10 or 12 exercises. That's it. So it's a lot for players and coaches to gain expertise in, no question, but it's not a lot in terms of number of activities that you have to focus on.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. In terms of rondos, Gary, for me, I think it's been like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years since I took my first U.S. soccer coaching course. And I remember like one of the guys in my class, it was on Zoom. One of the guys in my class is like, hey, and you know, I want to incorporate rondos into my session. Like, what do you think? And I don't remember the exact words that they said, but basically it was along the lines of U.S. soccer doesn't believe that rondos are game realistic. The players aren't getting a sense of the game. So we wouldn't recommend doing rondos. You know, why do you think U.S. soccer has been so against this movement of rondos? Obviously now with Pochettino as the head coach of the USMNT, you know that they're doing rondos every single session out there. And obviously not basic 4v1 rondos, but, you know, there's definitely rondos within those sessions.
Yeah. So why? The answer to that question is because they're retarded. That's why. But we touched on why there's this friction between, you know, us and MLS/US soccer, and it's more deeply rooted in their, I don't want to say hatred, that's a strong word, but distaste or dislike for Spanish football or Latino football. There's a cultural misalignment there that it goes beyond the game itself, if I'm being frank. And so they never really liked it when Pep was so successful with Barcelona, and they never really liked it when Spain was so successful on the international stage. And one of the reasons also why they didn't like it is because they didn't know how to do it. And since they don't know how to do it, and, you know, Spain, Barcelona, all these, the standard was exposing them kind of as frauds at that point, because their teams and their programs and their clubs weren't doing the same thing that Barcelona and Spain and all the great teams, Argentina, Brazil, were doing, you know, for years and years and years. And since these people here in the United States couldn't do it, they didn't have the expertise or the competence, the only way to defend themselves from being labeled as frauds is start lying to the public. And they might believe their lies. And so the lies are, oh, we don't have the players to do those sorts of things. Or, oh, we don't have X, Y, and Z infrastructure to be able to do those things. Or, oh, you know, our primary sports are football, basketball, baseball. Nobody cares about soccer. And so, you know, we're just not capable of doing those sorts of things. And so that cultivated this anti-Rondo, anti-possession-based soccer sort of sentiment. And your example of being in the U.S. soccer coaching course, which, by the way, I would never call it a course. I would just call it, this is a licensing scam. Okay. It's for you to get a license, and, you know, licensing is bullshit for almost all things. And they implement this licensing thing so that they can gatekeep who gets what in the ecosystem. But that's another topic for another day. It's interesting that you brought them up, because when we first released our quote-unquote famous video in 2012, the reception actually by the establishment was very positive, and I was getting pictures sent to me from coaches in the different licensing classes of the instructors using our famous video and using some of our materials being taught there. And it was only maybe after they kind of realized that, you know, we're not on the same page with the establishment, or I'm not on the same page with the establishment, that they kind of stopped doing that and actually started demonizing much of it.
Man, I'd love to see some of those pictures.
Sure.
You still have them?
Yeah. I'll have to dig them up. Imagine, it's over 10 years now.
Dig them up and I'll throw them in the show.
Okay. Or even better, because I know we have longtime coaches here who have been coaches for 20 years, who it happened to them. So if you're out there, if you're listening to the show, man, help me out here. Don't let me dig them up. Just maybe you can dig it up and send it on over to me.
Man, that's unbelievable. I didn't know that, because I had always thought that, you know, since the beginning that U.S. soccer was kind of against you and everything that you're fighting for.
No, not necessarily.
At what point do you think, like, the flip switch for them, where it's like, all right, you know, we can't align ourselves with Gary and 343?
Well, I've always been very direct online, and it's not that my level of directness or truth telling, unvarnished truth telling, necessarily changed. I just think they got to know me better over the course of the ensuing years, and they're like, maybe this, we don't want this guy to have too much influence over what, you know, the public thinks, or what coaches think, or what parents think.
Did it have anything to do with, like, this, was this during the time of Mendes and Oli getting shipped to Europe.
Oh, way earlier. Way earlier than that stuff.
Because then. you always say, right? MLS owns US soccer. So like when you upset MLS, like, all right, now.
Way earlier, Ben. So the famous video was 2012. Maybe they started seriously flipping or forming a campaign maybe around 2014-ish, something like that.
I wonder if they've had a meeting with their top executives just about
everybody,
you.
Everybody knows at the very top of the food chain. Every single person is aware. Every single person follows along.
Well, we've mentioned it already in this episode, Gary, but yeah. How does promotion relegation tie into all of this? How does promotion relegation tie into the golden rule of development? Do less, not more.
Yeah, golden rule of team and player development. Do less, not more. How does it tie into that? Well, we spent quite a bit of time talking about parental pressure on coaches, which is opposed to the golden rule, which the parents, from the parent perspective, which is the payer, they want you to do more, not less. Like, I'm paying money. I want to get the most out of my money. And so that kind of equates to doing more, not less. And so from that vantage point, the way to escape the parental pressure is, we discuss, is being successful on the field, winning games, then it kind of muzzles them a bit, or having a powerful DOC that believes in what you're doing and handles the situation for you and shields you from that vantage point. But if you have promotion relegation, you don't necessarily have to rely on those things, because with promotion relegation, pay to play will still exist, but it'll exist much, much less. There'll be far more clubs at scale, thousands at scale, who will have fully funded teams and programs, or much well funded teams and programs, because in a promotion relegation system, you have to win your business on the field. And so how do you do that? Well, you do that by trying to find what is the best methodology and deploying the best methodology. And it's all about the sport on the field. It doesn't have to do with the politics off the field. So if the best methodology is do less, not more, which there's consensus across the world that that is the way to go, then this kind of parental pressure evaporates a lot, also because there's no pay to play like there is now. So the parents have no say in how you actually teach the kids. What was the other thing that we had here? In an open ecosystem, the best ideas win, Ben. So if you're doing more, not less, you're going to lose games versus the guy who's doing less and not more. And ultimately, doing less, not more will eat up the entire ecosystem, because those are the ones who are going to survive, and all the other ones are not going to survive.
You've done it again, Gary. We can't stump you.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.